Welcome to the Three Martini Lunch. Grab a stool next to Greg Corumbus of Radio America and Jim Garrity of National Review. Three martinis coming up.
We've got two good martinis for you today, but you're going to have to wait for them because the bad slash crazy has to come first if you paid any attention at all to the Pennsylvania Senate debate last night. Jim, I couldn't watch it because on Verizon Fios, Nexstar, which owns News Nation, which hosted the debate, then a big fight. And so I don't get News Nation right now. But there was plenty of activity on Twitter in terms of the clips emanating from this debate, which went for an hour. John Fetterman had the opportunity to use the closed captioning system that he needs right now with his auditory processing. The Oz campaign had no problem with that. However, the problems were much deeper than whether or not there was a closed captioning system. Fetterman was every bit of what the NBC report a few weeks ago said he was in his inability to carry on a conversation. And we've got a number of examples of that here. First of all, being asked to clarify his position on fracking, since just a few years ago he had literally said he wanted to ban it. But of course, now he can't say that since he's running statewide. And here's how it came out.
I do want to clarify something. You're saying tonight that you support fracking, that you've always supported fracking, but there is that 2018 interview that you said, quote, I don't support fracking at all. So how do you square the two?
I do support fracking, and I support fracking, and I stand, and I do support fracking.
Then it came time to explain, or at least respond to the allegation from Dr. Oz that he hadn't paid taxes many years.
Mr. Fetterman, I will allow a 15-second rebuttal. He has specifically said you have not paid your taxes and that you want to raise taxes on Americans. How do you respond?
Absolutely. The Oz rule, of course, he's lying. It was helping two students 17 years ago to help them, you know, buy their own homes. They didn't pay the bills, and it got her paid. And it has never been an issue in any of the campaign before. It was all about nonprofit.
And finally, here's his response to Dr. Oz bringing up the shotgun incident that then Mayor Fetterman was involved in with a black jogger.
I made the opportunity to defend my community as the chief law enforcement officer there. Everybody in Braddock, an overwhelming majority community of black community, all understood what happened. You know, they understood what happened, and everybody agreed that, and nobody believes that it was anything about me making a split-second decision to defend our community as well.
Jim, from the reaction I saw on Twitter last night, it went from the first few minutes of, wow, he's really struggling, to how can the people around John Fetterman have allowed this to happen, not just agree to the debate, but allow him to remain as a candidate in this race?
Greg, as I was listening to that first audio clip you played about the fracking answer, I wonder how many listeners of this podcast thought their audio went out. That pause was so long and that silence was so awkward. And that, I think that probably was the worst of the night, but the whole thing was something of a struggle. And today's Morning Jolt, like, you don't have to look to what Republicans are saying. You don't have to look to see what my National League colleagues are saying. You know, the likes of Joe Scarborough and Axios and Politico and CNN and the Pittsburgh Tribune Review are all looking at this and saying, he struggled. I think Politico's playbook said it most succinctly. He really wasn't capable of debating Oz on that stage last night. And last night was really, it resolved a mystery that had been going on since May. Because at first, the first initial statements of Fetterman were like, oh, I'm already on my way to a full recovery. Then he had additional surgery. Then he was off the campaign trail for the better part of 3 months. And there was this question of, how is he doing if we can't see him? And there were statements from the campaign where he's recovering fine. He's recovering fine. He came out. He started doing appearances. And he would speak in front of audiences that were largely raving and, you know, cheering him for about 10 to 12 minutes. And the question was, how would he do when he wasn't in that very friendly set of circumstances? How would he do on a debate stage with, you know, questions directly posed to him? And I don't think there's really any dispute right now. Not only does he need the teleprompters, even with that effort to assist him, he had real trouble articulating his answers. Lots of candidates have misstatements, but they just seem to stack up rapidly in Fetterman's answers. My colleague John McCormick had a very sharp observation when he noticed that, like, we're used to politicians in debates and in interviews. They get asked a question and they answer the question that they wanted the interviewer to ask. They kind of dodge the question. In the case of Fetterman, when he did that, it was, well, is he dodging the question or did he not understand the question? And that is a still open question. And I think the response that you saw growing last night, like, it wasn't that, you know, folks on the right were mad at Fetterman. They were increasingly like they were embarrassed on his behalf, that this was actually, you know, really cringe inducing and painful to watch. And they got angry at Gisele Fetterman, angry at his campaign, and angry at the Pennsylvania Democratic Party for putting him through this. Michael Brendan Doherty, my colleague, noted he belonged at home last night. He belongs convalescing. He is not in any shape to run for Senate or to be in the Senate. And I was thinking, you know, I watched the whole debate on YouTube this morning, and I was thinking about how, like, the reason that the old 80s movie Weekend at Bernie's is funny is because it's so absurd, right? The guy dies, and they're trying to fool people into believing that he's still alive. So they raise his hand with a pulley, and they put glasses on him, and they carry him around and joke that he's been drinking too much and all this kind of stuff. And it's funny because if it were real, if someone actually literally tried to make a corpse and tried to fool people into thinking it was a real person, people would be horrified. People would be, oh, my God, that's an inhuman thing to do. John Fetterman is not dead, thank God. But clearly, he's in really rough shape. And for the past few months, the Democratic Party of Pennsylvania and his campaign have tried to fool people into believing that he's fine. And that with these, you know, 10-minute appearances and these short interviews and with the transcriptions of the remarks, it's kind of, oh, no, he's fine, he's fine. And clearly, last night we saw he's not fine. Connor Lamb should be running for the Democrats right now. Some other Democrats should be running for the Democrats right now. Malcolm Kenyatta was the name of the other state representative who was running for Senate. It should not be John Fetterman. And I don't know. It's very hard to believe how last night could have gone more for Oz the way he would have wanted it to be. And it's really hard to, like, how does the Fetterman campaign go on from this? They can't unring that bell. They can't dispel that image. They can't dispel these clips that are now going around social media of Fetterman struggling to answer those questions. The Pennsylvania Democratic Party and the people around Fetterman have really done both him a disservice and have done the state of Pennsylvania a disservice. And I will be shocked if this does not have, you know, significant consequences at the ballot box in November.
Yeah. Just a stunning series of events. Even though we kind of expected it could happen based on the clips that we've already seen. But to see it for an hour straight was very difficult to watch. As you said, and when we mentioned that they will have a debate, but it's late and early voting will be going on for a few weeks. As you have said many times, Jim, the people who are on the fence usually don't vote that early. And so if this was an issue that people had in their minds, they probably were going to stick around and wait. If you were a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat, you were going to vote for him whether you could speak at all. So if those people voted early, nothing much changed here. A tip for the Oz campaign, though, and anybody else helping them out here, you don't need to focus on this. People saw what happened. They can process that. They can factor that into their decision all you want. It's him lying about fracking. It's about his horrific record on keeping violent criminals in prison or not keeping them in prison. And on and on and on it goes. This guy's a radical. He was a radical before. He'd be a radical if he got to the Senate. So let the people deal with what they saw. You stay on the issues and point out that this guy's not ready to represent Pennsylvania.
Yeah. At that point, when your enemy is self-destructing, don't get involved. Let them react the way they like. And this is really a spectacularly self-inflicted wound by Democrats.
All right, on to our second martini now, and our first good one. There was actually several debates last night, Jim, but the other one we're going to focus on today is the New York gubernatorial race. A lot of polls had Kathy Hochul up by a very healthy margin until somewhat recently. And then Trafalgar and actually others now have Lee Zeldin pretty much neck and neck with Kathy Hochul. And Lee Zeldin put on a tour de force last night. If you've watched Kathy Hochul in public, you know she's pretty stiff and awkward, and you didn't expect her to be a fabulous debater. But Lee Zeldin came ready, especially on the biggest issues facing the state. When it came to soaring crime rates, he was talking about putting an end to no cash bail and making sure violent people stay in prison. And Kathy Hochul saying, I don't know why you think that's so important. But when it comes to crime and how to deal with it, Kathy Hochul's response, of course, is tougher gun control laws. Lee Zeldin was ready for that one.
And unfortunately, Kathy Hochul believes that the only crimes that are being committed are these crimes with guns. And you have people who are afraid of being pushed in front of oncoming subway cars. They're being stabbed, beaten to death on the street with hammers. Go talk to the Asian American community and how it's impacted them with the loss of lives. Jewish people targeted with raw, violent anti-Semitism on our streets. It just happened yet again. We need to be talking about all of these other crimes, but instead, Kathy Hochul's too busy patting herself on the back. Job well done. No, actually, right now, there should be a special session. The state legislature should come back and they should overhaul cashless bail and these other pro-criminal laws with zero tolerance. But they're saying, elect me. She says, elect me. And then you'll find out where maybe I'll stand on this issue in January.
Then he mentioned that New York has lost a significant portion of its population. And he likes to pose the question, that's because, and then he wants Kathy Hochul to fill in the blank, which she won't do, but he did.
For me, you ask me, why does New York lead the entire nation in population loss? Because their wallets, their safety, their freedom, and their quality of their kids' education are under attack. So they're hitting their breaking point. They're looking at other states like the Carolinas, Tennessee, Texas, Florida, and elsewhere. And they feel like their money will go further, they'll feel safer, and they'll live life freer. The state is at a crossroads. We were at a crossroads in 1994 when New York elected George Pataki. And we're at a crossroads right now. But as far as what happens with Kathy Hochul and one-party rule for four more years, outsized power of self-described socialists, we need balance and common sense restored to Albany.
And then it came to the nursing homes. Kathy Hochul has kind of skated on this because Cuomo, of course, was in charge for most of the draconian orders in New York. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in our third martini. But here is Lee Zeldin on the nursing home scandal.
And on top of that, talking about what happened in nursing homes, where was my opponent with the deadly nursing home order and cover-up? Why is it that the numbers are still on the Department of Health website that are outdated? What about the meeting with the COVID families who lost their loved ones, who were promised a long overdue COVID investigation, never got it? Why didn't you speak up with regards to the deadly nursing home order and cover-up? Why aren't you looking into the transparency and accountability that these families of thousands of deceased New York families have? Why didn't you stick up for the people who weren't able to see their loved ones in their final hours and being denied? You had time after time after time opportunities to stand up for these families, but you were silent or complicit or out to lunch every time. I don't know what your excuse is. But these families are demanding justice, and they will not rest until they get it. On day one, I will finish what you refuse to start and end.
Referee, stop the fight. Stop the fight. She can't take anymore. But he just kept at it throughout the debate. Kathy Hochul's got a terrible record. She's pandered to the left on anything and everything. And Lee Zeldin would be such an improvement there, Jim. It's a deep blue state. Most of the rational people, like he said, are leaving, or at least a lot of them. Hopefully there's enough left to put him over the top.
Greg, after about 8 o'clock, I tried to turn off the political part of my brain, spend time with the family and connect, but nobody was around. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to switch on C-SPAN. I'm going to see what debate's on. I guess it was probably around, was it 7 o'clock, I guess, is when the New York debate began. And I hadn't seen a great deal of Kathy Hochul on the stump or giving speeches. And I was, after a few moments, I was like, wow, why did Andrew Cuomo ever select her as a running mate? She does not give off warmth. She does not give off empathy. She does not give off a sense that she cares about your problems or that she understands your problems. And maybe if the circumstances aren't quite so severe, you can get attacked on your crime record and try to do a jujitsu and start talking about gun control. It's not going to work when the crime is so severe that your opponent has been nearly stabbed during a rally, has had drive-by shootings outside their house, and the guy who tried to stab him was released later that afternoon on bail. You notice you don't see Democrats defending the bail reform bill with any passion anymore. You notice that they don't really see them. It's always like, well, it's not directly tied to the crime. Yeah, you can't statistically prove. Yeah, it really was we will see if New York State is salvageable. I think Lee Zeldin's going to do really well. by historical standards, he's going to do really well for a New York Republican because the issue environment is just about perfect for him. Hochul has never been elected on her own. And I think she's just, you know, in terms of charisma, communication skills, everything you see there, she's really bad at this. Now, the thing is, New York's a really, really Democratic state. George Pataki was a long, long time ago. There really hasn't been anything resembling a competitive New York Republican Party in statewide in a long time. Downstate congressional races, yeah. And in fact, there's like five competitive states. And so Lee Zeldin just doing well, doing something akin to like we saw in New Jersey governor's race last year, that could have really big effects down ticket. But I watched it last night and I was like, you know what? I'm not going to say Zeldin is going to do it, but he's good enough to do it. He's a quality enough candidate. You could just hear it in those clips. He is fired up and he is angry. He is on a mission to save this state because it has been run into the ground. And Hochul just has this amazing tone-deaf attitude that things are going fine. So we'll see how it shakes out. I don't know if I can. I certainly can't guarantee he's going to win. But Zeldin has left it out on the field. And I think that, by and large, both the Republican Party and the state have been well served by that.
Yeah, that was an excellent performance by Lee Zeldin. And I think it's a template for others. Tudor Dixon seems to be doing fine in her debates against Gretchen Whitmer, but I think the way Zeldin characterized the nursing home issue, which would also apply to Gretchen Whitmer because she issued an order as well, very, very good. And so both of those governors need to pay a stiff political price for what they did there. And so we will see. We will see if it's possible for a Republican to win statewide in New York, even when the political winds should definitely be in their favor. That'll be an interesting test in a couple weeks. All right, Jim, on to our final martini and our second good one today. And that also comes from New York, much to the chagrin of New York officials like Kathy Hochul, like Mayor Eric Adams, and all sorts of other people. This might even go back to de Blasio, for all I know. But the New York State Supreme Court has said that it was not constitutional to fire municipal employees for not getting the COVID vaccine. In fact, the court not only ordered them to be rehired, they ordered back pay to the point where their employment was terminated. Now, we should point out that unlike other states, the New York State Supreme Court is not the final word. There's a couple other levels of appeal. And given the fact that they have had Democratic governors there for the past 15 years, I'm not sure that this is likely to last forever. But the reason here that this is being discussed is because the Supreme Court said, we now know that the vaccine doesn't actually prevent transmission, and therefore you can't go forward with this order. So it's an interesting clarification there, Jim. Like, again, we don't know what's going to happen ultimately, but it seems to be a big win for freedom.
This came up a bit in the New York governor's debate we talked about in our second martini, and I feel like this is another one where you can feel the ground shifting underneath the feet of the Democratic officials and Democratic candidates, and they don't really know how to deal with it. Zeldin got asked about this, and he said, yeah, I want you to get your shots, but I'm never going to make you do it. I'm never going to force you to take a vaccination that you don't want to have. And that, you know, is kind of what the stance of our governor here in Virginia, Glenn Youngkin, has said. I think that turned into the Republican consensus position that, you know, there are some Republicans out there who don't believe in the vaccines at all, and don't believe that they do any good. And I don't think that is an accurate assessment. Having said that, I don't think there's any dispute that the vaccines, when they were first unveiled, were oversold. And there was a whole lot of talk about this idea that once you get it, you can't get COVID-19. Clearly, that's not the case. The vast majority of people who've been vaccinated have gotten it. You know, a lot of people during the Omicron wave. Now, thankfully, the effects were not as bad as they might have otherwise been. But there has been this really unscientific and almost McCarthyist demonization of the people who chose not to get vaccinated. Now, some people chose not to get vaccinated because they believed in crazy conspiracy theories. Some people chose not to get vaccinated because they are afraid they'll have an allergic reaction. Some people chose not to get vaccinated because they're either pregnant or want to get pregnant, and they're concerned about the effects of that. When we saw this in New York State, where they fired quite a few hospital workers, and I was kind of struck by readers who were active in those hospital systems, who said, if you don't want to get vaccinated, I don't want you working for my hospital system. I think in the end, if you're going to be free, you have to be free to make decisions that other people think are wrong. the moment you say, well, actually, no, we don't believe you should be right to have that decision, you go down a very frightening path. And it's one of those things where, you know, Joe Biden himself really thought he had a winner on this issue. And unsurprisingly, some of the courts saw this quite differently. And I think we noticed, look at the situation we're in. Now, if he thought getting, you know, he did another, you know, he's getting his booster today, I believe. And he encouraged everybody to do it. And they talked about how COVID-19 could be a serious issue this winter. Now, Greg, didn't the president just say COVID-19 pandemic is over?
He did last month.
And so now, but you got to go out and get your shots. Now, look, if you want to, if you're asking me, I'm just a columnist, talk to your doctor. I think you should get the shot. Now, if you had a bad reaction to one of them before, don't get the shot, or at least talk to your doctor and say, am I allergic to one of these ingredients? Is there something in this vaccine that maybe I would have a strong reaction to, and it's not a good idea? Get your evidence from actual doctors, not people who play them on TV. But all in all, the idea that the federal government should be able to run around making you to do it, I'm not surprised that they lost this fight. And I think that this is a an indicator that the, you know, a lot of people in the name of public health got out way over their skis, and they're facing both a legal backlash and I think a political and cultural backlash as well, considering how many other things we were told about during the pandemic, i.e. the closure of schools and maybe where it came from, all turned out to be inaccurate as well.
The American people have many different things to focus on right now. They're trying to afford everything, their kids and school. And so, you know, the news cycle changes so quickly, it's hard to remember certain things. It feels like the Democrats are trying to bank on the idea that people aren't going to remember which party was much slower to open schools and that the Democrats weren't forcing vaccine mandates. I don't think that's going to work, but I don't know. Will it?
I suppose you could say they got out of the COVID-19 management crisis by creating the inflation crisis. You know, if you create enough crises in a row, people forget about which one is which and all that stuff. But look, it's not particularly good. And I do think that if there is, you know, I figured the COVID-19 cases this winter would be way lower compared to the Omicron wave of late 2021, early 2022. There was a stretch in early January 2022 where it just seemed like everybody had it. And, you know, you're starting to see that was having an issue on supply chains and things like that. And in our neck of the woods, we had a snow day of 1 week, which I think was secretly a backdoor effort to keep the schools closed when Omicron was at its worst. We will see how things shake out. But I have a sneaking suspicion that if COVID is bad this winter, quite a few people will be saying, hey, wait, wasn't this a guy who said he was going to shut down the virus? What happened? And also, this guy told us it was over. What's going on? You know, one more case of President Biden overpromising and underdelivering.
Yeah, I just got a note from CBS News on my phone here while we were talking, Jim, that says the U.S. is bracing for a triple-demic amid the exodus of healthcare workers. And I'm guessing that another part of that is going to be other things that are going to be popping up in folks. We're seeing this spike in RSV. The flu will probably be stronger than it has been the last couple of years because, you know, part of hunkering down for a couple of years means you're not as exposed to as much. And then once you are after that long layoff, guess what? You're probably going to get sick. So this could be an ugly winter, but it doesn't mean it's going to be a fatal winter. And again, when it comes to giving people mandates or giving them the freedom to choose with the best possible information, I think we know what the conservative position is here. Jim, quite a day. I don't know if we can get another set of debate performances quite like that for tomorrow. In fact, I'm pretty sure we can't, but I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about. So I'll see you then.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity, National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks so much for being with us again today. Do subscribe to the 3 Martini Lunch podcast. Tell a friend about us. Thank you very much for your 5-star ratings and your kind reviews. They really do help us out. So thank you in advance for that. If you haven't done that yet, get us on your home devices. All you have to say is play 3 Martini Lunch podcast. Buy Jim's new thriller, Gathering 5 Storms, and the accompanying short story, Saving the Devil. Follow us on Twitter. He's at Jim Garrity. I'm at @Dateline_DC. Have a terrific Wednesday and join us again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.
This week on the Federalist Radio Hour.
Is some of this the inevitable consequence of this sort of advancement of technology that shrinks the globe and ties us all together in ways that are very easy for anybody who comes to power? It doesn't matter if you're in a democracy or republic. It doesn't matter if you're in a monarchy or a dictatorship. When you have these tools and people are in power, you know, we don't have any sort of state of anarchy.
I'm Emily Jashinsky of The Federalist. Subscribe to The Federalist on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.